Welcome to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later, where we research the response of our past and review their relevance for today. This is your host, Moshe Kurtz. Welcome to another episode of Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. Today we have the schus, we have the true privilege to have Rabbi Yonah Reese with us, who is going to be discussing the topic about going to non-Jewish courts and also Jewish courts adjudicating based on non-Jewish laws. And Rabbi Reese is an excellent choice for the topic. We're very grateful for you to be with us because we should get to know a little bit about Rabbi Reese and why this is his choice of topic. Rabbi Yonah Reese is the Av Beis Din. He's the head of the Rabbinical Court of the Chicago Rabbinical Council and a Rosh Yeshiva at the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary at Yeshiva University, where he serves as the Rabbi Elkatz Chair in Professional Rabbinics. He is also the Sagan Av Beis Din of the Beis Din of America in New York. He previously served as the Max Marion Grill Dean of Reitz. Rabbi Reese received Yorah Yorah and Yad and Yad and Smicha from Reitz, and is also a graduate of Yale Law School, where he served as a senior editor of the Yale Law Journal. He has published many articles in Jewish law and on American law, including in Tchumen, the Wall Street Journal, and the New York Law Journal. Most recently, Rabbi Reese published the book Kanfei Yonah, Mazel Tov, a Hebrew language compendium of essays and responsa about contemporary issues in Jewish law and Talmudic topics. The books received approbations from leading rabbinic authorities throughout the world, including the two current chief rabbis of Israel. So as I said, it's a huge schus to have Rabbi Reese with us. Thank you so much for your time. And we're going to be looking primarily at a fundamental tshuva of the Rashba, Chelek Vav Siman Resh Nun Dalid. And can you tell us a little bit about this tshuva, why you chose the tshuva, and what we're looking to get out of it?
All right, well, first of all, thank you very much, Rabbi Kurtz. It's a pleasure to be on your podcast, and I am really honored to have this opportunity. I chose this tshuva of the Rashba, of course, by Rav Shlomo ben Aderet, who is a great Spanish rabbinic authority from the Rishonim. He lived from, I believe, 1235 to 1310. And many of the halachos that we follow in Shulchan Aruch in life really come from the discourses of the Rashba and his interpretation of the Gemara and his tshuvos in particular. And this tshuva is one that really has had momentous import in terms of the understanding and the application of the principle that the Gemara, that there is a prohibition of adjudicating cases between two Jews in front of the secular courts. Now, this is derived by the Gemara in Gittin and Daf Peichesam and Beis from the first pasuk in Parshas Mishpatim. Ve'elam Mishpatim Asher Tasim Lifnehem. These are the ordinances that shall be placed in front of them. Who is the them, the Lifnehem, that the pasuk is speaking about? So the Gemara explains, Lifnehem, V'lo Lifnei Akum. These are the Jewish law judges, meaning that you should present all of your ordinances, all of the disputes regarding all monetary disputes that you have in front of the Jewish law judges, below the Fnei Arkol Shogoyim, and not in front of the secular courts of the nations of the world. This is a prohibition to adjudicate cases in front of the secular courts. Now, the question becomes, does that prohibition only apply to bringing a case in front of the secular court? But what about applying secular law, even if you're going to adjudicate in case in front of the Beis Din? This is a very hot contemporary topic because people enter into business transactions and the like, sometimes really wanting to rely upon what we call the customs of the marketplace, what the standards are of secular society. You enter into a business transaction, and very often the expectations are that the business transaction will be conducted according to the norms of secular law. If the parties have stipulated that in their contract, is that something that should be honored by the Beis Din, or is it something that the Beis Din should not honor? Because maybe that is on some level a violation of Lifneihem, in front of them, you should go in front of the Jewish law judges, meaning the Jewish legal system, below Lifnei Arkos, and not in front of a secular legal system. And is it not on some level submitting to a secular legal system when you instruct the Bezin to decide a case according to a secular law. This became a hot button issue in recent times when the Medina Israel, was founded going back, of course, 75 years ago. And there was a system of courts that was put into place at the time that was based upon English law and Ottoman law and other legal systems, but not Jewish law per se, what we refer to nowadays as the Bagatz. And all of the judges, at least at the time, the judges were perfectly Jewish, but nonetheless, the code of law that they were called upon to apply was a code of law that was not premised upon Torah law principles per se. Some of you may recall that there was a movement known as the Mishpat Ivri movement that was headed by certain very fine scholars such as Menachem Elon, which stood for the proposition that the courts in Israel should certainly take into account Jewish law. They should be conversant in Jewish law. And Menachem Elon, who of course sat as a judge, the Israeli court system, made sure that whenever he wrote a decision, he incorporated a section which would analyze the applicable Jewish law that would be relevant to the subject at hand. But despite the fact that the Mishpat Ivri movement certainly referenced Jewish law, the cases were not, strictly speaking, adjudicated based on Jewish law. Menachem Elon was very good at figuring out ways of saying, well, according to Jewish law principles, we're supposed to defer to such concepts as Dina de Malchus Dina, the law of the land is the law, and even the idea of Minach HaSochem, that you follow the customs of the marketplace. So therefore, he said that based on an admixture of these principles, very often the outcome would be the same, even if strictly speaking, according to Jewish law, the outcome would be different. And there was much discussion about whether this assumption and this approach of Menachem Elon and the Mishpat movement was really a sound approach or not. The Chazon Ish famously wrote that this court system that was set up in Eretz Yisrael was intrinsically defective. I'll just make short reference of this before we speak about the Rashba a little bit more. The Chazon Ish, in his commentary to Maseches Sanhedrin, Simon Tezvav, the Sifkat and Dalit, said that if you would set up a system of laws that was based upon Boros Nishbarim, he said broken wells, and you would leave the Mekor Mayim Chayim, you would leave the Torah system of law, which is our foundation and the waters that we drink from, that even if Yaskimah, everybody would agree upon some sort of an alternative legal system, Harehim Mechalim is the Torah. That would be considered to be a violation, a desecration of the Torah. And he said that this is an application of the second part of the principle, which the Gemara speaks about. You should place the laws in front of the judges and not in front of the secular courts. So he said, also, you have to place your disputes in front of the Jewish law judges and not in front of individuals who are unlearned, lay people who do not know how to apply Jewish law properly. Now, the Ramban, his commentary on the Chumash, says that second part of the principle is different part from the first part. Namely, when it comes to adjudicating a dispute in front of unlearned laymen, so then you could say, well, says that this is not something we're supposed to do the chatchila, but if both parties agree that they're going to take some ignoramus to decide their dispute, that they would be allowed to do so. They can make a tanai, generally speaking.
That'd be arbitration, right?
Sure, you have a principle called tanai shiba momen kayim. It would be arbitration because the person wouldn't, strictly speaking, be a full-fledged dayan, but the person would just be deciding the cases according to their sound judgment, but not necessarily utilizing a separate standalone legal system. So that would be okay. However, if a person would decide, two people would decide, they're going to adjudicate their case in front of going to make a tanaya condition. For us, it's okay. We say, no, that's not okay. The Shulchan Aruch rules is null and void. That's what the Ramban says. Why is it null and void? It's null and void because it's considered to be making a condition with respect to something which is not just a davar shebemamon, something which is a monetary matter, but something which is a davar shebeisur. It's a ritual prohibition to go in front of the secular courts. It's a desecration of God's name. The Rambam says, some of it is considered like your Meir Miyad, B'Torah Moshe Rabbeinu. You're raising up your hand against the Torah Moshe Rabbeinu. So here, that's exactly what the Chazon Ish says. He says, it doesn't matter if you come in front of non-Jews, trying to decide the case according to laws that they have made up. And he says, it's even worse. They have switched and they have reviled the laws of the Torah for the an alternative legal system. Even if everybody would agree, he says that it's not considered to be a valid agreement. He says, because you're raising your hand against the Torah Moshe, and you create an alternative legal system, even if all the judges would be Jewish, but they're bidden and duty-bound to apply secular law. So here, we no longer have the principle of the Ramban, that just because they happen to be Jewish, you can accept them, because this is an example where you're actually accepting a different legal system upon yourself, and that is considered to be Meirim Yad B'Torah Moshe Rabbeinu, lifting up your hand against Torah Moshe Rabbeinu. So the question is, how far do we apply this objection of the Chazon Ish? Question, yes.
Right. So it sounds like the fundamental issue here is that it's almost like it's an insult. It's that we have the opportunity to keep the laws of the Torah and then we dafka replace it with something else. It sounds like the Lashon of the Rambam is it's a rebellion of sorts against God. Though I know that we've mentioned the principle of Dina d'Malchus Dina, which is a general idea that we're supposed to follow the laws of the land. And that's, of course, very relevant to this topic. I think we'll speak to this as we explore the Rashba about how Dina d'Malchus Dina has been unfortunately coupled together with things like Vahavta Recha Kamocha and Kavod Habrios, which are all legitimate concepts in halacha, but they are expanded beyond their limits many times. Dina d'Malchus Dina, as Rav Ries mentioned, as you mentioned, it applies to Dine Mundus, to monetary matters, but you can't apply Dina d'Malchus Dina certainly to ritual matters, to marital matters. But even within monetary matters, we'll see in the Rashba, I think, in the moment, that it's not so pashut, it's not so simple that we could just use Dina d'Malchus Dina as this elastic concept to basically use perforated pages on our chelek of Choshe Mishpat.
That's 100% correct. And that's a perfect segue into the tshuva of the Rashba. So the question becomes, what if it's not a replacement of the entire Torah legal system, but parties in an individual case just happen to come in front of the Bezin and they stipulated in their contract that they want their business dealing to be conducted according to secular law? Is that legitimate or not? Is that also included in what the Chazon Ish was fulminating about? Or is this something which is more legitimate? We do know that, as we mentioned earlier, parties are allowed to make conditions of the Mishnah in Bava Mesiyah. Daf Tzadi Dalet says that a shoel chinam can stipulate he'll have the obligations of a shomer chinam. Can stipulate have the shomer sachar. The shomer sachar can stipulate he'll have the obligations of a shomer chinam, and that's considered to be perfectly fine. And we consider that to be binding based on the principle of Kol Tanai Sheba Mamon Kayim. So what if instead of saying, oh, as a Shomer Chinam, I'll take upon myself to be obligated to be Geneva Babed like a Shomer Sacher, the Shomer Chinam says, I'll take upon myself to be obligated according to whatever secular law would obligate me to be liable for. So is that considered to be beyond the pale? So the Rashba dealt with a case, this is Chelik Bava Siman Reish and Dalet, where there was a situation where a man married off his daughter. We'll call him the father-in-law, marries off his daughter to a man, and he provides a beautiful dowry, a nice nedunya for his daughter. And then the daughter and the son-in-law, they have a child, they have a daughter. So very nice. Now he has a married daughter and he has a granddaughter. But unfortunately, what happened was that the daughter died, and then afterwards the granddaughter died. So now he comes back and he says, okay, there's no longer a marriage, and there's no longer any offspring from the marriage. So the father-in-law said, I want my nedunya back. I want the dowry to be returned to me. And the son-in-law said, nothing doing. I inherit the wife. That's the Torah law. Either it's a din Torah or a din derabbanan machlokis, the nature of a baal yoish is ishto, but certainly according to Jewish law, husband his wife, who inherited his daughter as well. So therefore, he said that he gets to keep the dowry. And the father-in-law said, this is ridiculous, because where we live in this particular country, we should follow the laws of the country. In this country, the law is that every single time that that you have a short-term marriage and the wife dies and there are no offspring from the marriage because the children die within a short period of time, so then the dowry that was provided by the father-in-law goes back to the father-in-law. We should follow the law of the land based on Dina de Malchusa Dina. And this is considered to be something that everybody would have in mind, that they're going to follow the law of the land. So they wanted to know, is this something which is not? And the Rashba really consists of three different parts. And here's where there's confusion in the Rashba, because many people really only hone in on one part of the Rashba, or they mix together two different parts of the Rashba that say totally different things. It's important to understand what the Rashba says, because the Rashba seems to completely contradict himself. The Rashba starts off by saying, yeah, well, number one, we have a principle called Dava Shema Mamon Kayim. You make a condition, it's perfectly fine. If, in fact, this was the course of customary dealing in a place where Jews live, where it was always stipulated that the husband would give up his right to inherit his wife. So the Yerushalmi talks about such an idea of a husband giving up his Yerusha from his wife. This is, the Bible also talks about it, the Yerushalmi in particular talks about such a practice that this was done on a regular basis, especially for short-term marriages, because unlike most Yerushas, unlike most inheritances, when it comes to the inheritance that a husband has from his wife, he actually can waive. He can be Masalik himself. He can waive that Yerusha. If he does it between the erusin, between the betrothal and the nisuin, and the actual marriage, special laws, nachla ba liadam imakam acher, special laws discussed in the Gemara. So if that was the custom that everybody did it, so he said 100%, then that would even hanosim shamastam, even if a person didn't make the stipulation, if that was a sort of the agreed upon custom of the area, we would follow it 100%. No, the father-in-law should win the case, according to the beginning of the Rashba. Then the Rashba switches gears. Oh, does he switch gears? Then the Rashba says, the second part of the tshuva, when we call Malkam Lino came, Neshu Mishpat Goyim, but to do that, because you want to imitate the laws of the non-Jews, and you're doing it not because it's the customary way of dealing of the Jewish community, but because you don't respect your Torah law, and you want to imitate the non-Jewish law, nearly she'asur, that would be prohibited, l'fishu mechakes goyim, because then you're doing it to imitate the non-Jews, v'zehu. And this is included, says the Rashba, in the prohibition that we've been discussing, shesiva Torah, lifneim alo lifnei goyim, that you have to follow the laws of the Torah and not go in front of the secular courts. Apal pi sheshneim rotzim, even if both parties would want to do so. And the Rashba over here seems to indicate that even taking upon yourself a secular law, if it is based upon the desire to follow the ways of the non-Jews because you respect their legal system more than our own legal system. So then he says that would be a terrible, terrible thing. And he goes on to say, the kol sheken, and how much more so, imata yosifu lakto lako nachla sa'aba labonim, you're going to do away with the whole notion of inheritance of a father, and you're going to be mapil chomo satoira, you're going to raise down, you're going to tear down the walls of the Torah, ve'okia shorish ve'anav, and you're going to destroy all of the roots and all of the branches of the Torah. That would not be a good thing. And that's the end of the second part of the tshuva by the Rashba. In other words, the Rashba says, you do it as a matter of business custom or common personal family custom within the Jewish community, no problem. You're doing it because of the fact that you want to imitate the secular laws and you want to uproot our system and replace it with their system. So that's when you have a problem. Yes.
If I may even supplement, there was one line that really just jumped out to me along the same theme that he says later. He says, "Umalanu leSifrei Hakodesh Mekudashim Shechibru Lanu Rebbe VaAch Rabbeinu Ravashi." What do we need? Like all these, the whole rabbinic canon that we have. Yilmudus B'neim Dinei Agoy. You may as well just teach your kids Gaish Law. Why do we need to learn Gemara? Why do we need to learn Halacha if this is what you're going to do? You're going to be Oker Kol HaTorah Kula.
And everybody loves that line, and that's the most memorable line of the Rashba when the Rashba gets around to saying, "What do I need all of our bookcases of Svarim for if we're not going to pay any attention to them?" But what people don't realize is the Rashba didn't say that line in connection with this part of the tshuva. The Rashba said that line in connection with the next part of the tshuva, part three of the tshuva. Part three of the tshuva begins with the words, "V'omer ani shekol asomek b'zeh lo ma shemuta mishumdina d'machus adina toh v'gazlanu." Anybody who thinks that you should follow the secular law because of the principle of dina d'machusa, you follow the law of the land, that's a big mistake. And if you're going to take money from somebody on that basis, you're going to be considered to be a gazlan. Why is that? As the Rashba points out, the principle of the law of the land being the law is only applicable to a very small subset of governmental powers, such as the ability to levy tax and the ability to say whoever pays somebody else's property tax, if that person is failing to pay the property tax or the one who pays the tax is allowed to take over the land. Those are things that have to do with very broad-based economic regulations that the king would really care about in terms of running a smooth and efficient and effective society. But when it comes to interpersonal interactions between two Jews, a loan between two Jews, a partnership between two Jews, a neighborly dispute between two Jews, a Yerusha, an inheritance between two Jews, the king doesn't care about that. The king does not impose laws that relate to those types of interpersonal interactions, and therefore that is completely irrelevant to the entire domain and principle of Dina de Malchusa. That is really the crux of what this tshuva of the Rashba is all about. And in that context, the Rashba said, if you're going to follow Dina de Malchusa, when it comes to all of our monetary laws, you'll have nothing left of all of the Gemaras and all the Rishonim and all of the Achronim and all the Shailos. The tshuva said that there would be no point, because we would just follow the laws of the society around us, and all of the Torah laws would become irrelevant. So the question, and then after all of that, the Rashba finally backtracks, and the Rashba says, but to what degree is Dina de Malchusa relevant? Yes, when it comes to taxes, when it comes to building bridges and stuff, and eminent domain and things of that variety. And also he says, Ashi Yisrael Osim Yisrael Chavero. And so too, if you have a transaction between two Jews in which the two Jews accept upon themselves that they're going to follow the Dinei HaMelech with respect to an individualized transaction, when it comes to a davish mamon, a monetary matter, you can obligate yourself to give somebody something that you're not obligated to give. Just like a shomachinam can say he's going to take upon himself the obligations of a shoel, of a borrower, that he'll be chayav beonsin, for example. So what in the world is he backtracking? He's so incredibly strong and incredibly assertive in his position that you cannot take upon yourself these laws because of the secular courts. And then he says, it's all fine and dandy to make it tonight. So what in the world is going on over here? So I'd like to, we only have a few minutes left, just give you several different approaches within the Rashba that I think help us understand how the Rashba was really interpreted and applied by the classical later halakhic authorities. So one is the Beis Yosef. The Beis Yosef interprets the bring in Simen Chabav in a very limited context. The Beis Yosef brings the Rashba simply to stand for one very short proposition, which is that you're not allowed to adjudicate cases in front of the secular courts. End of story. That's all that the Beis Yosef says. Says the Rashba says that B'tavas Chasnu B'arkos Agoyim. This, the Rashba was talking about a case where the father-in-law sued the son-in-law in the non-Jewish courts. And he's pointed out that you cannot allow to do that. That's how he interprets it. The Rashba doesn't really seem on its face to be talking about a case where you went to secular court. That's what the Beis Yosef said. Number two, if you look at the Shulchan Aruch later on in Simen Shin Samach Tes in Choshen Mishpat, so here's where we have the official codification of the laws of this particular position of the Rashba. And it says over there that Lake of Azeb, Mishum Dina Damahusa. So here we have the other application of the how it's brought in the Shulchan Aruch, that in terms of the way in which the inheritance would go to the husband and would not go back to the father-in-law. So in that particular case, says the Shulchan Aruch, Lake of Azeb, Mishum Dina Damahusa, that we don't follow the Dina Damahusa. In other words, the way that the Shulchan Aruch is not in terms of the prohibition of imitating the non-Jews when two private people make a condition with each other, but simply that, let's say they didn't make the condition with each other, but one party says we have to follow this rule because it's Dina de Malchus. He says, no, when it comes to inheritance, we don't follow Dina de Malchus. This is not a sweeping economic regulation like bankruptcy law, rent control law, or something like that. So that's how it gets codified in Shulchan Aruch. Number three, let's say that it's actually a secular law that the parties want to take upon themselves. What about the concern of the Chazon Ish, that you're uprooting the Torah? So you could say the Rashma himself tells you what our litmus test is. The litmus test is, are you doing it in order to be mechakes agayim? Are you doing it because you don't trust the Torah legal system? Or are you doing it because this happens to be the minhag hasochim? This happens to be the custom of the marketplace, the custom of your business, the custom of your profession, the custom of your family, the custom of your community. But not that you uproot Torah law when it comes to other things. So it could be that that's really the distinction, and that's what a Beis Din has to look at in any individual case, where the Beis Din has to decide whether to respect a particular choice of secular law in a particular case. Yes.
Excellent. So thank you so much for those different approaches. And I just want to, in our last few minutes, dig into that final approach, which is it's about giving deference to the non-Jewish legal system and the non-Jewish ethos. So you're the expert in Choshe Yemish, but not me. But I'm familiar very, very generally with the Shaar Chetzi Zachar and these methods that we've come up with, because the case of the Rashba is that it starts with a case in which the father slash husband by Torah law should be inheriting his wife, inheriting his daughter, and they want that the grandfather slash father will get the Nedunia back. So the question is, nowadays, it seems to be, as society's become more egalitarian, we have also, I'm just saying this as an observer, we've also found a halachic workaround to enable that daughters can inherit from their parents as well, even though according to Torah law, it should just be the sons. And I know, I think when I learned him, why, I think it was Rav Willig who said, you still give a set of shas to the son as a symbolic thing. But the question is, I think it's a question locally about this method of inheritance. And if possible, if Rabbi Reese, if you could speak to, when is something a harama? When is something a circumvention of the Torah, whether it's formally masa masha kasa of the Torah, or even just ethically, meta-halachically, when is something seen to be overriding or in conflict with Torah values and we're circumventing the Torah? And when is something like a Pro's Bowl, which is perhaps like the most common example that gets cited, when is it a legitimate innovation that preserves the needs of the Torah?
I think it's an excellent question, and I think it boils down to what is according to the Ruach HaTorah. What's according to the spirit of the Torah in terms of what you are accomplishing? Are you doing something that furthers the goals and purposes and principles of the Torah, or something that diminishes the purposes of the Torah? So I think in the Yerusha context, there was always a notion that we find in the Torah that even if somebody doesn't inherit, a person during their lifetime has the ability to give an individual gifts. You can give intra vivos during lifetime gifts, and it's perfectly fine, as long as you're not avurei achsanta, as the Gemara says, as long as you're not using the gifts as a way to bypass the system of inheritance entirely. So if you leave over a certain amount of your estate that's going to be distributed according to strict inheritance laws, that's perfectly fine, even if a very strong amount of the estate is going to a significant amount of the estate is going to be given to other individuals, as long as it's done in the fashion of matana, of giving a gift. And that's how the Shtar Chetzi Zachar classically work. A person would give a giant gift to their daughter. In fact, the gift would be so much, there'd be nothing left of the estate, but they would say to the sons that as long as you are comfortable giving a half of the amount of the estate to the daughters. They're not going to inherit exactly like the sons will inherit half of what the sons inherit. So then this gift is going to be null and void. So the gift would be sort of an impetus for the sons' shares to the daughters, but the sons would still get their rightful Torah shares. That wouldn't be in any way taken away by this process. So it would be the same idea nowadays. We don't do a shtar chatzis zocher. We do what's known as the shtar zocher sholem, that the daughters get equal shares with the sons, but it's given in the same fashion in which what they get is basically through gifts. And then a state, usually the sfarim or something like that, is distributed according to a strict Torah law. So how is that according to the Ruach HaTorah? Look at last week's parsha. He gave everything to Yitzchak. So the only one who inherited Abraham was Yitzchak. That was the divine decree. Abraham had other children. He had other children from Hagar, from the Pilachim. What did he do? What did he do with other Pilachim? He gave them matonos. He couldn't give them Yerusha and he gave them gifts. So that's pure, perfectly in accordance with the spirit of the Torah. So to enact something like this, we just have to determine, is it in accordance with the spirit of the Torah? And we have to make sure, as the Rashba said, not to uproot the idea of the Torah scheme of inheritance entirely. And that's the way in which modern day halakhic wills and the Shtar Chatzi Zocha, Shtar Zocha Shalem are implemented nowadays.
Right. And I think perhaps you will agree with this. Who is able to determine what's in... what's consonant with the Ruach HaTorah, that would be the Gedolei HaPoskim. That would be the Rabbanim who are, you know, Shakua. They are involved in Torah, and they would have the best sense of what the Torah would want in a given situation. It's not for someone like me, you know, Moshe Kurtz, you know, Joe Pulpit Rabbi, or some guy out there to start saying what the Ruach HaTorah is. We have to rely on those who are actually Vagisa Bo Yom Valayla, who are actually studying the Torah to have the best sense of the Torah intuition. Would you agree with that?
100%. You want to make a prusbel, you have to go to Hillel. Only Hillel can enact a prusbel. Not just your stabbing, you know, everyday rabbi, you know, of any community. It's something that requires the Gedolei Ador to really look into these things and figure out the appropriate enactments. And that's why you need the guidance of a Rashba Chazon Ish to figure out even how to regulate the principle of Lipneihem, Lo Lipnei Arkos. The bottom line is, you can't go to secular courts for anything. In front of a Beis Din, there are occasions when it would be appropriate to apply secular law when it's in accordance with principles of Tanai Shemimamon or Minhag HaSochrim, or the limited arena of the broad-based economic regulations to fall under the rubric of Adina de Malchus Adina. But to uproot the entire system of Torah law in order to replace it with secular law, that is beyond the bounds, so that would be something that would be prohibited.
So very briefly, halacha lemaisa, in Eretz Yisrael, going to a court in Israel, what's the issue there? If one goes to a court, which is presumably Jews are presiding over it, but they're using mishpat ivri or something that's not purely halachic, and then also, what about in America, when someone goes to, let's say, the Beis Din of America and they do arbitration, are these decisions always being made based on the Torah? And if not, then is that okay? In Eretz Yisrael, I know that's a lot for like 2 minutes, but
it's a lot for 2 minutes. But in Eretz Yisrael, people should go to the Bati Din. There are Bati Din. There are Bati Din that have been established by the Rabbanut that have authority when it comes to marriage and divorce and personal matters. That they are not given authority for some reason to adjudicate monetary disputes, but people can through arbitration go to the other Bati Din that are around. There are some very fine Bati Din, Eretz Chemda, Nesiva Samishpa. There are very fine Bati Din for. That parties can go to, and that really is halakhically based on what the Chazon Ish wrote, exactly what people should do. Here in America, Baruch Hashem, we have Bati Din here as well. You go to the Beis Din of America, so there's a principle that the Beis Din of America has in its rule book, rules and procedures, that if parties do decide to choose that they want their dispute to be adjudicated according to secular law, so then the Beis Din will apply that choice to the fullest extent allowed under Jewish law. If it's something that's beyond the pale of Jewish law, because of the fact that, for example, it's a ribbis transaction, and ribbis is not a monetary matter, it's a ritual prohibition, so then the condition doesn't count. However, if the condition was in accordance with Minhag HaSochrim, they just wanted to follow the standards of divinity, it wasn't because they were looking to uproot the Torah. So then even according to the Tshuva of the Rashba, the way that we pass in Shulchan Aruch, that would be perfectly fine to say that every single monetary law of the secular system is automatically applicable because of Dina de Malchusa. That's not something that the Bez in America would say, and that's something where we do certainly pass in the Halacha, as the Rashba said, that we're not going to uproot all of the Svarim of Rabin and anybody who came afterwards. But Torah law still remains extremely relevant and extremely primary and paramount in all of our lives, as it should be.
And that's an excellent note to end on. Very articulate and very unequivocal. And Rabbi Reese, thank you so much for your time and for lending your expertise to this very fundamental Tshuva of the Rashba and giving a deep dive into understanding what it's really saying so that people like me who just gloss over it when preparing a shir for Shal Shudis, now I have a bit of a deeper understanding of this Rashba and what it means not just for the court system, but really what it means to be a Jew living right now in the 21st century. So thank you so much, Rabbi Reese, and wishing you continued hatzlacha, and thank you for all that you do for Klal Yisrael.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. Please make sure to subscribe to get the latest updates. And if you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to rate us and leave a review. Do you have a response to the response that you want to share on the show? Please send your letter to the editor to MitchellMKurtz@gmail.com. And God willing, we would love to consider your perspective to be shared on a future episode. This is Moshe Kurtz, and I look forward to reviewing more responses with you next time on Shoot First, Ask Questions Later.